Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
Man, gotta love them hippies. You know, y'all know some hippies? Oh, I couldn't resist. I just could not resist. As soon as that guy started talking about bearded people, except for I couldn't find a picture of both Alex and Jonathan Bradford in the same pic. That's what I really wanted, but anyways, so I had to smack that in there. I'm sure I'll pay for it later. So we're in our series on Romans, and I got to let you know, before we get any further in Romans covers so many different topics throughout that I'll read through passages and you'll be like, oh, he just skipped right over that. Well, yeah, I'm going to skip over a ton of stuff. There's too much stuff in here to cover for me to cover every single thing. What I'm trying to do is Paul starts with a premise in chapter 1, verse 17 that we looked at last week, okay? And he carries this premise, this argument, this point throughout the entire book, okay? And so we're really just going to be focusing on that one thing. What he does, though, in the midst of talking about that one central issue, he brings up a lot of supporting evidence. And all those supporting evidences, you could preach sermons and do whole series on a lot of those supporting evidence pieces, but really we're just going to be focused on sort of the main message of the gist of the book of Romans. And that, of course, deals with right and wrong. In other words, that age-old question of, if I've done something wrong, how do I make it right? How do I get back to the place of rightness again? How do I undo that? How do I sort of get back to a good place with other people and with God? And Paul gives us the answer to that in Romans chapter 1, verse 16 and 17. He starts off the whole message, and he says, listen, when you've done something wrong and you want to make it right, it's pretty much like this. He says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. In other words, I'm not ashamed of the good news. The word gospel simply means good news. I'm not ashamed to tell you the good news, okay, of Christ. So he says, I'm not ashamed to tell you the good news of what Jesus did for us, is what he's saying there. I'm not ashamed to tell you the good news of what Jesus did for us, for it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes. For in it, the righteousness of God, in other words, everything that God does, or sorry, I just say the righteousness of God basically is going to be given to us. So how do I make my wrong right? The only way to do that is for God to give me righteousness, okay, to give me the rightness and to take the wrong stuff I've done and give that to Jesus to die on the cross for my sins. That's the amazing good news of what Jesus has done for us. That's the gospel, that Jesus takes my wrong and he pays from the cross and he gives me his rightness. So he says, that's what he's saying here, Romans chapter 1, verse 16 and 17. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from first to last, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Basically, the bottom line is this, when you have a relationship with God, he gives you his rightness, and he takes on your wrongness, and he pays for it on the cross. And if you just trust him to do that, if you have a faith relationship with him where you're trusting and saying, God, do this for me, he makes you right. That's pretty much the whole summary of everything he's going to talk about in this book, is that one premise. You might say, well, why does he have to spend the entire book with that one premise? Well, because throughout history, we've found in other ways, we've come up with earlier ideas of how to deal with our wrongness. And the hippies was a great social experiment in that. And probably the number one way throughout history that humanity has tried to deal with their wrongness goes all the way back to the garden. What was the very first sin? Adam and Eve looked at God and they said, God, we want to be the ones to determine what is right and wrong. Satan says to him, the day that you eat of it, you'll be able to determine what is right and wrong. And so basically, in other words, what happens is that when I'm doing something wrong, my conscience is like telling me, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing this? You know this is wrong. And in that moment, I should say, oh my goodness, God, I've done something wrong. Help me deal with this. Make this right somehow. God, I just ask of you, whatever you can do. And he says, don't worry, I got it covered. Jesus will take that. We'll die for it on the cross, and I'll give you my rightness. Bam, problem solved. Instead, what do we do? Oh my gosh, why am I doing this? I shouldn't be doing this. This is wrong. Wait a minute. Who says this is wrong? Who tells me this is wrong? Who are they to tell me what to do anyway? I don't even think this is all that wrong. The only reason why I feel bad about this is because society says it's bad. The only reason why I feel bad about this is because the church tells me it's bad. The only reason why I feel bad about this is because other people have made up some rules to get everybody to conform for their own ends. And I don't have to play by their rules any longer. And that's what the hippie movement was all about, right? That's what he says. It was this grand social experiment. Now listen, we're going to see in a minute, every generation does this. But the thing about the hippies is they were so bold about it. I mean, they announced, listen, Everything y'all doing is wrong. If you're over 30 years old, you don't know anything. We've come up with a new way to create an entire new society, and we're going to do it. And we're going to blaze new trails, and this is the future. I mean, they were bold about this. Like, everybody else sort of, like, makes it a more sophisticated, sort of underground, sort of subtle. We'll look at that in a minute. But the hippies were just out there with it. And so right after Paul says, how do you make things wrong right again? He says it's through a relationship with Jesus. However, people go down a different path. That's where he goes next. Verse 18, he says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth through unrighteousness. In other words, the wrath of God is revealed in heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. In other words, things that are wrong. So God's wrath is poured out when you do wrong. Now, when I say God's wrath, immediately most of you are thinking of hellfire, brimstone. You're thinking of some church that you don't want to get caught in. Have you ever seen the movie Pollyanna? You probably know from that. There's a pastor who's up on this. Anybody ever seen Pollyanna? This guy gets way up on this pulpit, and he just yells to people about the fire and damnation that they're going to be facing. Maybe you think of an Old Testament God. Maybe you think of a God who's making a list, checking it twice, and unlike Santa Claus, who's got presents, he's got a big stick in his hand for anybody who messes up, because that's the wrath of God. Well, to begin with, I'm not denying there is a reality of hell. But what he's saying here is that the wrath of God is poured out when you do wrong. In other words, can you not at least see that when you do wrong things, there are consequences for doing said wrong things? And you can try to go and blaze a trail, and you can convince yourself that what you're doing is right, there's nothing wrong, and the only reason why it's wrong is because everybody else says it's wrong, but it's really not wrong, and I can make up my own rules for what I want to do. You can come up with it all you want. But what are the consequences? It's everything you saw in that documentary. Now, here's the thing. That was not like some Christian documentary going back trying to explain Romans 1:18. Okay, that's not at all what that was. That was the History Channel. It was Lou Ray Productions, or Ray Productions, I can't remember the name, but I think it was Lou Ray Productions, was contracted out to make a documentary on the hippies. That's all they were told. Just go make a documentary on the hippies because we're doing a series and we want to have a documentary on the hippies. And so what they did is they just talked about this social experiment that was the hippies, and then they talked about how it failed miserably. And it was funny. I went through and was reading. I was looking for that video online, and I kept finding these chat sites about it that were like modern hippies who weren't happy with the documentary. It was like, yeah, man, it was basically saying, you know, it was a failed experiment. I don't think so. Really? Let's see what they learned. Drugs are bad. We experimented. We tried everything we could possibly do. We used to think, you know, drugs really aren't all that bad. Just bad people have bad trips. Good people have good trips. And, you know, it can really open up your mind and expand the reality. And there's so much potential in your mind that just needs to be unlocked. And if you just do some acid or do some other drugs, it'll unlock everything and make everything better. He says, yeah, we tried all that. We came to the conclusion drugs are bad. Okay, we've learned that. Free love. Do what you want. Don't let marriage constrict you. The covenant of marriage and the oneness of the relationship. You know, that's just all an old repressive generation who doesn't understand your body and your times and what you need. And they don't understand that if it feels good, you can do it. And if it's love and you feel love in the moment, then everything's all right with that. What could possibly be wrong? He says, well, ask the kids. He says there were awful consequences for the kids. There was no stability, and there was a deep emotional wound that was left in them. And many of you all either grew up in that situation or your parents grew up in that situation. So did all that work out? No, there was consequences for that. There was pain as a result of that. All right, then the guy's like, you know, well, we had the pill. So in other words, what ends up happening, you'll see throughout time, is what we've done since about 1960 or so and on, we basically said, okay, yeah, there are some consequences of doing what it is that I'm doing. So if I can use technology or medicine to somehow counteract the consequences of it, then it's no longer wrong. Did you get that? That's what the pill was. The pill basically said, you know, if you have sex outside of a marriage, it can result in babies, but we've solved that. And that solves all the problems. Okay, well, what about the venereal diseases? What about the emotional impact? What about all the emotional wounds and scars? Oh, yeah, part of the failed experiment. And I didn't even get a chance to go in there to talk about all of the young people who went out to Haight-Ashbury that he mentions in there is this intersection in San Francisco, which kind of became like a tent village of hippie community out there. He talks about all of the women who went out there just seeking this new life, this great freedom, And they found they were basically sucked into a sex trafficking trade that was going on way back then because they had no way to support themselves and they would get abused and taken advantage of. And then the drug dealers came in and the gangsters came in and the Hell's Angels came in and they all were looking to abuse the system. And he says that was really the result of all this stuff. And then he goes on, people set out to determine right and wrong. And then here's the thing, once again, that was not a Christian video. And what does the secular historian, the sociologist say happened in the people? They got a God complex. The more they determined right and wrong for themselves, the more they had this God-like sense about themselves. And that God-like sense about themselves, did it move them towards love like the one true God does? No, what did it move them towards? Violence. Did you get that? How could getting closer to God or becoming like God move you to violence? Because it's a false reality. Because I would do violence so I could assert my power. And the more I could assert my power over somebody through violence, the more I felt God-like in the midst. So what happened when we rejected the truth of God and exchanged it for the lie that we can set up our own right and wrong? Well, we became gods unto ourselves. We determined right and wrong, and the result of that was we found drugs were bad. It had devastating consequences for the next generation and our generation, our own emotions, along with disease. There was consequences of murder, some guy who thought he was an orange, and we had just a tolerance for a psychosis because, I mean, you hear that? There's a tolerance for psychosis. People basically were saying, psychosis isn't bad. If he feels like he's an orange, then maybe he's an orange. And we kind of look back, and the reason why we love about the hippies is we look back and we go, man, what idiots, morons, how could they be so dumb? But is our day and time any different? I mean, you came out of the 60s, you move into the 70s and 80s, and we thought that technology and medicine and money could fix all of our problems. And we could look to technology, medicine, and money to somehow counteract all the consequences of doing wrong things. And we'd say, you know, it's not wrong anymore because we've got a fix for it now. We have a cure for it. We have a way to get around it. The future holds all kinds of possibilities. And then you moved into the 90s and postmodernism was just in flourish. And postmodernism was this idea that, you know, that all truth is relative. What's right for you may not be right for me. And what you think is wrong may be wrong for you, but it's not wrong for me. Is that not just a fancy way of saying, I'm going to do what I want to do? Nobody can tell me what to do. I'm gonna do what's right in my own eyes. Isn't that really all postmodernism was? And it was a new thought. Bull. It's been around for centuries, for millennia. It's right here in Scripture. You know, flat out. The wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. What's the truth? That there is a God. And that's where he goes next. We suppress the truth that there is a God. He goes on to say, for what may be known about God is clear to them, since science has shown it to them. The invisible things about him, the eternal power, his deity, have been clearly seen from the creation of the world and understood by the things that are made, so that we are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they didn't glorify him or give thanks to him as God. And so they became futile in their imaginations, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. That's one of the classic lines of the Bible. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. How many people back in the 60s thought that everybody who was older than them was an idiot, and they had this newfound reality. They found that they had unlocked the keys of wisdom to life, and the reason why you don't get it because you're so darkened in what you believe and what you think, and you're so overshadowed by the man and everything else that you just don't understand. This is the way of the future, and this is going to work. And we look back at the hippies, not just their dress and their clothes, but their attitudes and their ideas, and we go, idiots. But if you ask them back then, they'd say wise. And you go back to the 80s and look at all the opulence and the way we glorified our greed, and we go, idiots. You look at postmodernism now, we've been thoroughly debunked. And we look back and we go, idiots. And where are we at now? Well, now we're in the age of my wrong choices are civil rights issues or human rights issues. And if you disagree with what I think is right and wrong, then you have a problem. And you're hateful, you're bigoted, and every other closed-minded thing you want to get. And what's really odd is now we have no idea because if you say this is right and I say this is right, we can't even figure out where we're going to go to the bathroom anymore. Is that not where we're at? Why? Because we all get to determine right for ourselves. And when we all do that, we're beginning to see this isn't quite working out. There's a few things we need to work out here. Like maybe having individual bathrooms so you can be whatever you want to be when you go in there. Why? What are we trying to do? We're using our technology and we're using money to medicate this idea that you can do or be whatever you want to be. You see where this is going? And on and on and on it goes down this path. He says, listen, when you exchange and you walk away from God, this happens. Now, why is it fundamental here we walk away from God? Because if there is a God, I know he has a say, right? Why do you think humanity is clinging to the shaky science of macroevolution? Why? Because if I look to macroevolution and realize that it does not work out, the only other option we go to is, then there must be a God who created it all. And I could preach a whole sermon on this. I will just summarize with one quote from a guy named Robert Jastrow, who is an American astronomer, a planetary physicist, who was one of our leading NASA scientists until he passed away in 2008, wrote several books. And he did not start off as a theologian or anything like that. That's not where he was at. He was just simply a scientist looking at the stars. And he says, astronomers now find that they've painted themselves into a corner because they have proven by their own methods that the world began abruptly in an act of creation to which you can trace the very seeds of every star, every planet, and every living thing in the cosmos and on Earth. They found that all of this happened as a product of forces that they cannot even hope to discover. That there were what I or anyone else would call supernatural forces at work is now what I think scientifically a proven fact. Why don't you hear anybody else talking about this? Because we suppress the truth to support our unrighteousness. That's what he says in Romans. We're suppressing truth so we can support our own ideas that I can make up my own sense of right and wrong. That's why you don't hear this taught. Although you'll find scientists and physicists and astronomers over and over and over again all pushing this one reality. He goes on, for a scientist who has lived by faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. What did Paul say? Claiming to be wise, we're real idiots. He says, he has scaled the mountains of ignorance, and he is about to conquer the highest peak. Just picture this mental image now. He's scaling this mountain of ignorance, believing in evolution, believing that we're all here by natural consequences. There is no God. He says he has scaled this mountain of ignorance, and he's about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself up over that final rock, he's greeted there by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries. Now we see how the astronomical evidence supports a biblical view of the origin of the world. The details may differ, but the essential elements in the astronomical and the biblical accounts of Genesis are one and the same. The chain of events leading to man commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment in time, a flash of light and energy. That's where science is pointing. But why don't we hear that? Because we want to suppress the truth to push the idea that there is no God, and if there is no God, then I can do whatever I want. And don't mistake this for 1 minute. You think you're getting a unbiased view from a scientist. No, there is no unbiased view. You get that? There is nobody who is unbiased. Can we agree on that? There is nobody. Everybody who comes in, everybody has skin in the game. And nobody wants to admit this, okay? They think that just the Christians have skin in the game. No. Everybody realizes if I get to the point where I say there is a God, there is some supernatural force that created the universe, I recognize right in there it's an issue of right and wrong that I no longer get to control. And so I will fight tooth and nail to support this theory as long as I possibly can. Why? So nobody can tell me what I can and cannot do, regardless of the consequences I see in my own life. How is the wrath of God poured out? And the way that he made the system, and the way that he made humanity. He basically says, you do this, it works. You don't do this, it doesn't work. For instance, we don't try to do the kind of things we do with our morality and God anywhere else. A friend of mine who was put in charge of a joint forces battalion over in Afghanistan doing some rebuilding work. He says he was there, and it was the first time working with army troops, and they were setting up a little camp there and pounding some stakes into the ground. He looked over, and he saw one of the soldiers picking up a mortar shell, using it as a hammer, the back end of it as a hammer, where the firing pin is, banging and banging and banging, and finally somebody tackled him and threw him on the ground and said, what on earth do you think you're doing? He says, I just needed something, heavy to pound this thing in. Now, can we agree that the wrath of God was about to be poured out against his unrighteousness in that moment? Right? And nobody would look back and say, how could God allow something like this to happen? No, you'd say, he's a moron and he did it. Right? Yet, we'll pull back from society, we'll look at all of the consequences of our own wrong choices, and then we'll say, how could a loving God allow this to happen? You're a parent, you know what it's like, right? I have one child who's about to move into this scary phase called adolescence, okay? What I love about the birth, pre-K, elementary phase is, let's face it, I can control every aspect of their life. I mean, from sun up to sundown, I'm in complete control. I drop them off to somebody else, and let's face it, as a parent, if you don't like what the school's doing, you can speak your mind, and they will conform to what it is you need to do if you speak it loud enough and hard enough, right? You can conform every area of their life. You can micromanage everything that they do, and they need it, right? Somewhere around 18 to 28, though, you realize you have no more say, right? You have some ideas, you have some guidance, you have some influence, but you don't have the control, right? Adolescence is that place where you have to give up control. You have to give it up. And the same way God has given up that control over your life, he's not going to micromanage you. He lets you choose your own course. And if you want to look to God and say, God, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm going to do my own thing. He says, okay, go do your own thing. If that's really what you want to do, then go. I love what Mark Twain said. He says, you know, I'm amazed at the wealth of information my father learned between my ages of 18 and 25. Right? Because it's, you know, when I'm 17, 18, I know it all. Dad doesn't know anything. I got into my own ideas. But Dad has a wealth of wisdom that he's trying to impart to me that he's learned from his own trial and error, maybe even from God's word at some point along the way. But I think I can do my own thing, and I've tried, I failed, I see my consequence. What's it say God does? There's three summary statements that are used in here for what God does in Romans chapter 1, verse 24, 26, and 28. It says, God gave them over to the impurity. God gave them over to their shameful lusts. God gave them over to their debased mind. Basically says, you want to go that route? Go for it. I'm not stopping you. See how that works out. For the hippies, they figured out the hard way. Us in our lives, every one of us has a battle scar of saying, you know, I did my own thing, and God gave me over to that, and it consumed me. And this is what happened as a result. As that great theologian, Dr. Phil McGraw, says, how's that working out for you? And what he says ends up happening, when you walk away from God, he says, what comes up in there, over in verse 24, says, therefore God gave them up to this uncleanliness through the sinful desires of their hearts. Now, that's not a really good translation there, because there really is no good English translation of this word, sinful desires. It's epithumia in the Greek. It is a super passion, a super desire. It is an all-consuming focus. He's saying, listen, I'm going to give you over. You want to go on that route? You go over that route. What's going to happen is you're going to have an all-consuming focus that takes over on you. Just a lust for that one thing. See, lust isn't a good word because we think of it in sexual terms, but just think of it in an all-consuming compassion, or all-consuming passion. Bottom line is you are created to worship. You are created to center your life around something. You are created to pursue something with everything in you. And if you do not pursue God, you will pursue something. And whatever it is you pursue other than God will eat you alive. That's what Paul's saying. And if you don't like my word for it, or his word for it, listen to David Foster Wallace. I shared this a couple years ago in the series, When Life Sucks Everything Out of You, but it comes back to truth here. This guy was an atheist. He was a professor at a university. I think those are probably almost redundant terms. And he simply says this at a commencement speech. Blew everybody's mind, like, where's this guy coming from? How could he possibly say this? But he says, you know, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there really is no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Keep in mind, this is not a pastor. This is not a pastor. This is just a college professor who everybody knows has been atheist all of his life, and he gets up and he shocks everybody by saying this. And he says, there's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice you get is what to worship. And perhaps the most compelling reason for choosing a spiritual God like Jesus Christ or others is that pretty much any other God you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if that's where you tap into real meaning, you'll never have enough. You'll feel like you never have enough. If you worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, then you'll always feel ugly deep inside. And when time and age begin to get the best of you, you'll die a million deaths before you actually die a real one. If you worship power, you'll end up always feeling weak and afraid, just having to assert your power ever more over others to the point where you can just numb your own fears. If you worship your intellect and being seen as smart, you're always going to feel deep inside that you're just a fraud. And someday somebody's going to find out how much you really don't know. And then he ends with this, but the most insidious things about all these forms of worship is that they're unconscious default settings. We don't even realize when we walk away and say there is no God, what we're doing is basically saying, okay, what else am I going to pursue in worship? What else am I going to pursue with all my passions? What else is going to become my epithumia, my overarching desire, my lust, my greed, my desire, my I got to have it? For some of you, it's a stuff. For some of you, it's a thing. For some of you, it's a relationship. For some of you, it's some sort of emotional high gained for it by some substance or by someone, whatever it is. And that becomes an all-consuming passion or an addiction or whatever it is you want to call it. And when you exchange the truth of God for the lie that you get to determine your own right and wrong, you give yourself into, you get sucked into this desire that you can't control. And God says, go for it. If that's what you want to do, then go. See how that works out for you. So what's the application for you and for me? Well, this is hard. These next 3 weeks are going to be really hard because I mentioned a couple weeks ago, we can't see sin in the mirror. We can't see it. We are blindly self, what's the word? Self-righteous. What is self-righteous? That's where I'm determining that what I'm doing is right. Isn't that the definition of self-righteousness? And Paul's saying that's the issue, that's the problem. The reason why you don't see the gospel as good news is because you don't hear the bad news. The bad news is you're not right. You're doing things that are wrong. And everybody in here is thinking to themselves, no. What, tell me, if I'm doing something wrong, what is it? I don't know. I don't know you well enough. Sometimes I do. So you'll come to my counselor, I'm like, do you need me to tell you this is wrong? No. How's it working out for you? Not good. Would it be fair to say the wrath of God is being poured out and revealed to you in this area because you've said this was right, but it's really turned out to be a wrong thing? Yeah. You see, we may have our own standards for our relationships and what I can do with my body. We may have our own definition when it comes to greed and selfishness and what I do with my money. We may have our own perspective on what I'm owed or what I deserve, either from God or from anybody else. And you may want God to simply agree with your own standards. But the wrath is being revealed in the fact that you have emotional issues, psychological issues, physical issues, financial issues, and every other form of wrath that's being poured out in your life in these areas where you said, I'm going to do my own thing in my own way. So the question, of course, is, are you going to get to the point where you say, okay, God, show in me, reveal in me what it is that I've so missed? What is it in me that I've done where you're saying this is not the right way to live and I need to go in this direction? Will you show to me where it is I am self-righteous? Because I don't want to be self-righteous. I only want to be right because I'm in relationship with you. And if that's going to be true, I first need to realize where I am wrong. I need to have the bad news before I can really enjoy and receive the good news. Paul says, I'm not ashamed that I need, that I have, that I want to share the good news. What would you be ashamed of? The very thing that you don't want to acknowledge. You see, we're ashamed because we're doing wrong. And Paul says, I'm not ashamed. I'll just go out and tell you. Paul would say, I am the worst of sinners. I don't deserve any of this. And I'm not ashamed to tell you I need good news. But in church, the message is always, look at me, look how great I am, look how perfect I am. Can't God love me now? No. Not until you realize you're only righteous because of your relationship with Jesus Christ. God, show me. God, reveal to me. God, expose me. What is it in me that is my own standard? I'll close out with the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus went to a highly religious culture who believed in righteousness like you wouldn't believe. And he would say over and over again, you've heard it said of old that this is what is right, this is what is wrong, but I say to you, and he would raise the bar on everything. Some of y'all would say, well, I never committed adultery. Yeah, have you ever thought about it? No. That's not wrong. Look but don't touch is my policy. That's not God's policy. He says there's harmful consequences just from looking and don't touching. And you could go on and on and on and on and on down the road. You see how easy it is to say, look how good I am and look what I'm doing because you've distorted the standard of God. The whole Sermon on the Mount is basically saying you've distorted the standard of God. You're not right because you're right in your own eyes. You're only right because you're in a relationship with God. Would you join with me as we close? Father, we can make fun of the hippies all day long. But could it be that 50 years from now, people will be making fun of the things that I'm doing and the things that I'm thinking? And if my reason and my logic for my decisions was ever revealed and laid out in such a bold way like it is in the hippie generation, every one of us would be exposed. So, Father, may you open our eyes and reveal to us the bad news, the reality, the unrightness in our life. We might no longer try to whitewash it or cover it up or rationalize it or justify it, but simply accept it and confess it and cast ourselves before your feet, asking and begging that you, in your mercy and in your grace, would allow Jesus to die for that sin and give me a rightness that comes from simply being in relationship with you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.